from Tehran to Mashhad by train and then visited other cities by bus. I met a lot of different people, not just Iranians, but also tourists from other countries. As foreigners, we were impressed with the Iranian people's warm response and their positive attitude. It was a very interesting, unforgettable, and beautiful trip. I hope I can visit Iran again.
Vienna's Book Fair is the center of a week-long national reading festival involving hundreds of authors in dozens of venues.
Although many feared the book industry would not be able to weather the storm of the pandemic, hopes have actually risen for the industry, with people reading more in lockdown, some even discovering for the first time the unique kind of pleasure that reading provides. Homa Lezgi, Vienna.
On Sunday, the Afghan capital Kabul hosted a webinar titled Muslim World Ulamas and the Recent Developments in Afghanistan. Top clerics from seven Islamic countries, namely Afghanistan, India, Pakistan, Iran, Palestine, Iraq, and Croatia, participated in the event. They said the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan opened a new chapter in the country, adding that it's up to the new rulers to form an inclusive government and maintain stability.
Afghans are proud people. They succeeded to defeat the U.S. and its allies and free their country. We hope the new administration learns from the past and understands that no one can rule over Afghanistan with dictatorship and oppression. I think Afghanistan must have a popular and inclusive government in order to prevent disputes.
We welcome the recent developments in our country, as it is meant to cease hostilities and violence on our soil. We are happy that our people don't hear the news of war every day, or at least hear lesser than they did during the invasion. But the fact is that recent terrorist attacks show that we are still far from permanent security and peace.
The attendees also stressed the need for Islamic solidarity and urged the Taliban and Afghans to stay awake and knowledgeable to foil enemies' scheme.
My advice to the Afghan people is that they should launch an educational movement and everyone should be illiterate so that they can detect enemies' plots. In addition, there should be a solidarity between Muslim brothers because their enemies are trying to sow sedition between Shias and Sunnis, especially by carrying out deadly attacks.
Addressing the conference, the clerics also asked the Islamic countries to help Afghans amid difficulties and economic hardship. The participants of the webinar stressed unity among all Muslims, especially in Afghanistan. This as the Taliban government is yet to be recognized by world countries and people are facing looming crisis. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
A two-day photographic and film exhibition on the annual pilgrimage of Arba'in began in the Italian capital on Saturday. Arba'in marks the 40th day of the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein, the third Imam of Shia Muslims. It is commemorated annually through a march being the biggest in the world and known as Arba'in Pilgrimage from different countries to Karbala and holding ceremonies in the Iraqi city. The photo exhibition, organized by the Imam Mehdi Islamic Association and the NGO Arba'in Travelogue, showcases a selection of photos from the world's largest gathering in late September this year. The main focus of the initiative is global justice.
We do our best to bring the message of Arba'in to Europe, to every country, to every city, to every each of one of those people, and say the truth that Arba'in is follow the global peace, global justice. And global justice, global peace, global empathy is what we're missing now.
There is an amazing atmosphere in Karbala. Iraqi people welcomed us the best way they could. The first time I went there, Saddam Hussein had just been removed. I traveled all the way from Iran to the Holy Shrine. It was an unforgettable experience.
Despite the COVID-19 pandemic, hundreds of thousands of Shia Muslim pilgrims converged on Karbala in late September to commemorate the end of the 40-day mourning period for the death of Imam Hussein.
People at the photo exhibition say Arba'in should be seen as a model for our societies, one in which each and every one of us has a role, irrespective of our nationality, financial status, and ethnic or religious background.
I think it would be really nice to take it as a model because you see that everything is there organized by people who are doing their best without any rules, without any fines, without any pushing from the outside. So it can be implemented to our daily life. And hopefully I would say that the people could be inspired by it and try to have it in their daily life as much as possible.
Ciò che avviene durante la marcia del 40esimo.
What happens during the Arba'in can inspire our societies. Generosity, sacrifice, selflessness, these are values that better our societies, and that's what we should all aim at.
Some 14 million worshippers attended the Arba'in in 2019. Max Civili, Rome.
Ten innocent family members were killed by a U.S. drone strike on a home in Kabul. After the attack, the Pentagon apologized for the mistake and said the U.S. is considering making payments to the family of the victims and will get them out of Afghanistan. But it seems Washington has been indifferent to its promises as the family still awaits justice.
The attack was very horrific to our family. It martyred 10 of our loved ones and shocked those who have survived. When our relatives come here, it hurts them as they remember those innocent children martyred here. Of course, the U.S. should be held accountable.
Justice should be done to us. They promised that those responsible would be tried in a court, compensation would be paid, and they would take us out of Afghanistan. After their announcement, they have done nothing. They must stay true to their commitments.
Afghans and U.S. war survivors have repeatedly asked for meaningful transparency and accountability for the U.S. killings of their loved ones, but they have not received it from Washington so far.
The U.S. has always lied to these people. They make promises but don't fulfill them. For instance, see Ajmal's family that were decimated by the U.S. All of those killed were innocent. It has been 3 months that their relatives are left helpless.
People also believe that during its invasion of Afghanistan, the U.S. military has always killed civilians, lied about it, and finally exonerated themselves. More than 2 months after this tragic attack, the U.S. has not taken any practical steps to reach out to the victims' family or pay compensation to them. And the survivors are still awaiting justice. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
In the limelight. Its ambition was clear. The United Nations climate summit in Glasgow, Scotland, was meant to secure a deal to give the world a chance to avert the worst impacts of climate change by capping global warming at 1.5 degrees Celsius, 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit, above pre-industrial levels. The article you're about to hear has been written by Reuters news agency journalist Kate Abnett, Valerie Volkovici, Richard Valdmanis, and Barbara Lewis. The piece is titled, Was Glasgow Pact a Win for Climate? Time will tell. Its ambition was clear. The United Nations climate summit in Glasgow, Scotland, was meant to secure a deal to give the world a chance to avert the worst impacts of climate change by capping global warming at 1.5 degrees Celsius, that is 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit, above pre-industrial levels. The accord met that bar, but just barely, and its ultimate success will be determined by the future actions of the governments that thrashed it out, according to the summit's UK hosts, participants and observers. I think today we can say with credibility that we've kept the 1.5 degrees Celsius within reach, but its pulse is weak and we will only survive if we keep our promises, the summit's president, Alok Sharma, said late on Saturday after the pact was adopted. The deal, backed by nearly 200 countries, for the first time explicitly targeted fossil fuels, the biggest driver of man-made global warming, asked governments to accelerate emissions cuts, and promise more money for poor countries struggling with climate change. It also ushered in voluntary pledges and pacts from countries, companies, and investors to clean up emissions from cars and from planes, curb the powerful greenhouse gas methane, protect forests, and bolster green finance. But the agreement was packed with compromises, leaving all sides, from wealthy nations seeking faster action to resource-rich developing countries and low-lying island states, dissatisfied. The approved texts are a compromise, said United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres. They reflect the interests, the conditions, the contradictions, and the state of political will in the world today. That leaves the world highly vulnerable. We are still knocking on the door of climate catastrophe. It is time to go into emergency mode, Antonio Guterres said. The summit did not deliver enough emissions-cutting pledges from countries to set a clear path to limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. Instead, it struck a deal for the nearly 200 countries represented at the event to increase their pledges next year to close the gap. But the gap is huge. Governments' current pledges to cut emissions this decade would lead to a 2.4 degrees Celsius rise in temperature, in global warming terms. To align with the 1.5 degrees Celsius rise, that's the target, countries need to cut carbon dioxide emissions by 45% by 2030 from 2010 levels. Under current pledges, emissions would rise by nearly 14% by 2030. While compromises at COP26 keep the 1.5 degrees Celsius rise target within reach, it is hanging by a thread, said Bert Wonder, the acting chief executive officer of environmental group Avaaz. China, the world's biggest carbon dioxide emitter, announced in a joint declaration with the United States last week that it would accelerate efforts to reduce emissions by curbing coal use, tackling methane, and preserving forests. It provided few details, however. China was also among a group of resource-rich developing countries that watered down language targeting fossil fuels in the text of the Glasgow deal. The draft called on countries to phase out coal use and fossil fuel subsidies. But as the negotiations played out in Glasgow, words were changed. Coal became unabated coal, leaving scope for continued use of coal that uses emissions capturing technology. Subsidies became inefficient subsidies, without a definition of which types of subsidies counted as inefficient, providing wiggle room for governments to continue funding oil, gas, and coal. A last-minute intervention by India and China just before the pact was adopted in Glasgow also changed the requested coal phase out to a phase down. The Glasgow Agreement delivered a mixed bag on finance, a contentious issue between poor countries and their richer and powerful counterparts. Finance boils down to the issue of fairness and whether rich countries whose historical emissions are largely responsible for causing climate change will pay the costs of its imposing on the world's poorest countries. The deal made some headway. It asked developed countries to at least double their collective provision of climate finance for adaptation to developing countries' parties from 2019 levels by 2025. It also, for the first time, made mention of loss and damage in the cover section of the agreement. Loss and damage refers to the costs countries are already facing from climate-driven disasters, for which those countries have for years sought compensation. But after resistance from the United States of America, the European Union, and other rich industrialized countries, the accord failed to secure funds for that compensation. The world's most vulnerable countries backed the final deal grudgingly in Glasgow. The negotiator from Antigua and Barbuda, Leah Nicholson, said her country and other small island states at the talks in Glasgow will express our grievances in due course. Rich industrialized countries broke a 2009 promise to deliver $100 billion annually by 2020 in climate finance, making poor countries wary that promised cash will not arrive. They now expect to deliver the $100 billion by 2023. Ravi English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to Ravi English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Ravi English Radio.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of information.
The Spotlight.
Iran's President Raisi says that the Islam Republic is serious about talks aimed at securing the rights of Iranian people by removing all sanctions imposed on the country. Negotiations between Iran and the P4+1 is slated to be kicking off in Vienna on November 29th. Tehran wants the party that left the deal, that is the United States, to lift anti-Iran sanctions and offer guarantees not to scrap the deal again.
Vienna talks between Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal are only 2 weeks away. But U.S. President Joe Biden has so far refused to return his country to compliance with the accord or remove Washington's unilateral sanctions on Tehran. That despite the very fact that the UN-endorsed deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, was reached during his vice presidency. Iran has times and again stressed that the removal of U.S. sanctions in a verifiable manner is the main agenda of the upcoming talks. Tehran also says that it is ready to reach a good agreement during the Vienna talks, but not at any price. President Ebrahim Raisi says his government is serious about the talks that should aim to secure the rights of its people by removing all sanctions. Iran's stance is echoed by Russia. During a phone call with Raisi on Tuesday, Russian President Vladimir Putin reaffirmed his country's support for nuclear rights of the Iranian nation and the removal of sanctions. Also last week, the Russian foreign minister said his country would seek the full implementation of the JCPOA in the Vienna talks. Sergei Lavrov also called on the US to honor its obligations, which include lifting all sanctions on Tehran. Also on Monday, deputy foreign ministers of China and Russia, during a virtual meeting with their Iranian counterpart, stressed that Washington's unilateral withdrawal from the JCPOA and its sanctions are the main obstacles to the implementation of the accord. Former US President Donald Trump withdrew his country from the accord in 2018 and reimposed all the anti-Iran sanctions that had been lifted under the deal. Iran waited for a year to see if the European signatories could salvage it. But the European inaction prompted the country to begin gradually scaling back some of its commitments under the JCPOA. Now the current US president says Washington will return to its compliance with the deal if Tehran does the same. The Islamic Republic stresses that it was the US that abandoned the deal and must take the first step toward its revival by removing sanctions. So far, the actions taken by the Biden administration contradict its words that it wants to return to the accord. Last week, for instance, Biden encouraged other countries to stop purchasing Iran's oil. Experts believe Washington's withdrawal from the JCPOA, as well as its failed policies globally, have damaged its credibility.
I think the Biden administration, in spite of Mr. Trump's withdrawal from JCPOA, certainly undoing that may do Mr. Biden some good, but I think, unfortunately, Washington's credibility has been damaged, not just because of the JCPOA, but all these other accords that some people in Washington, especially the last occupant of the White House, thought or assume he can just walk in and walk out of.
No matter what happens in the upcoming talks in Vienna, but one thing is clear, though. Washington's influence in West Asia is waning. The US and its Western allies have already failed in their plot to topple Syria's President Bashar al-Assad, despite years of backing they provided to terrorist groups there. In Yemen, US logistic and military support for years-long Saudi war have failed to bring the Yemeni people to their knees. And the US hasty withdrawal from Afghanistan recently proved it spent billions of dollars of taxpayers' money on the futile war.
Welcome to the Spotlight. I'm Behrouz Najib, and today we're discussing JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal. Let me introduce our guests in this edition. Editor of the Veterans Today, Mike Harris, joining us out of Phoenix, Arizona. Also with us, we'll have political commentator and peace activist Brian Taro from Malloy, Iowa.
Is the Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to the Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome, gentlemen, both to the show. Let me turn to Phoenix. Mike, Iran officials have stated that clearly that they're intent on serious talks in Vienna aimed at sanction removal. What about Washington? Is it serious?
That remains to be seen. One has to realize that sanctions are really a very soft form of warfare intended to weaken the targeted country. And as long as sanctions are in place, Iran or any other country, Russia, for instance, has to be wary that the intention of the country imposing the sanctions, in this case the USA, is to weaken them over the long term by denying them, you know, expendable products and parts of the things that that help sustain an economy and help sustain a country. And so if Washington was truly serious about this as a gesture of good faith, they should at least begin removing the sanctions, perhaps in a phased manner that would allow the Iranian government to gain some confidence that Washington is indeed sincere in their talks about reinstating the JCPOA and coming to some sort of an accord.
Right. Now, Brian, there are contradictory words and actions, and they make you wonder what exactly the White House is after. You know, they want Iran to go back to the negotiating table, so why don't they impose fresh sanctions instead of removing the previous ones, like just Mike referred to? And is the U.S. sending the right signal this way?
No, it's not. And I would disagree on a slight thing with our with the other speaker that sanctions are not a soft form of warfare. It's a very deadly form of warfare, and it's a matter of life and death. And there are people who are dying who don't need to die because of these sanctions. It's a very aggressive and very violent. It is a form of warfare, yes, but there's no such thing as any soft warfare. But I don't think it's in the interest of the U.S. to have a have an agreement here. It's in the interest of the U.S. or the people of the United States and our stated objectives, but it is not in the interest of the military-industrial complex, which really is the driving force in this country. Peace breaking out, in the words of the CEO of Raytheon Corporation, is something to be avoided, and he's hoping that the Middle East will remain a place of positive growth in the coming years.
Mm-hmm. Now, Mike, apart from the optics and the rhetoric, do you see any change between the performance of the past and current U.S. administrations when it comes to dealing with a so-called maximum pressure campaign and sanctions against Iran?
Well, I don't see them having any effect at all. One of the things that the sanctions has done anywhere that the U.S. applies them long term is they force the country that's being subjected to the sanctions to develop their own in-country supply chains and become more self-reliant. So truly, they're making the country stronger and not dependent upon international trade or international goods. Right. So they're making a more self-reliant, more resilient country rather than weakening them, because anything that can be done over in another country can also be done internally to the country that's being sanctioned. So this has been very noticeable in Russia, and is also noticeable in Iran because of the manufacture of pharmaceuticals and other things that's been occurring that have been withheld from these countries. So sanctions are really self-defeating. They're damaging in the short term, but in the long term, they create a more self-reliant country. So the U.S., what they're doing doesn't work. The U.S. State Department is broken. They've had misguided policies. They've been misguided since 9/11 broke out and this whole war on terror thing. The previous guest was correct that the war machine likes to be fed, and they're hoping to keep this stirred up. But there's a better approach to this, and that is, what is the source of the animosity that the U.S., Israel, and a lot of the West has against Iran and against Russia? Are they just looking for the next victim to plunder, to create a war? Or is there a deeper underlying cause? And once these questions are answered, we'll have a better view into what the real motivation is of the U.S. And so if we're going to talk the JCPOA, Iran give up nuclear weapons, why not have the Middle East give up nuclear weapons? In fact, the entire world give up nuclear weapons, because Israel has a very robust nuclear program and nobody discusses it. And the U.S. is violating its own laws that says that they can't give aid or can't do commerce with any country that's not a member of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. But yet Israel has more influence over the U.S. Foreign policy than the American citizens do.
Exactly, and then the U.S. has used a bomb against people in Japan. Iran never initiated any war. Okay, Brian, I wanted you to draw a comparison, if there can be, any comparison between the present U.S. administration and the previous one when it comes to sanctions and all that pressure on Iran. Any change?
No, I think your previous question about what, aside from optics and rhetoric, is the difference. Mm-hmm. You take that away and there's no question anymore. You can't talk about it anymore. But I think it's right that we need to focus on whenever there's a proliferation of weapons or threat of proliferation, rather than look at the new countries coming along, look at the fact that, as our friend said, with Israel, we have plausible deniability. Israel's a huge nuclear force in the area. And because we can't talk about it, they get to have the threat of using nuclear weapons without having the accountability. And we're violating these laws all the time. The United States is presently in the taking part in a $1 trillion, more than $1 trillion program to modernize our nuclear weapons. And in 2019, there was a report by the Joint Chiefs of Staff of the United States that said nuclear weapons could have decisive results for restoration of strategic stability and create conditions of how commanders can prevail in combat. So if for these past decades we've not had a nuclear war because the very fact that it's unthinkable, that the results would be, everyone would lose and there's no winner in a nuclear war. Well, the United States is now putting a lot of money into the idea that a nuclear war can be won. And if we're looking at the threat of nuclear proliferation, we need to look at the United States first. And if any talk about sanctions, I'm saying this as an American too, that sanctions ought to be brought against the country that is driving this race and in nuclear weapons and provoking hostilities, in Iran, in the South China Sea, on the border with Russia. These are provocations that are going on daily.
Okay. Now, Mike, as you know, Tehran embarked on marathon talks with world powers, eventually signed the nuclear deal known as the JCPOA. It did remain in full compliance as endorsed by the IAEA until more than a year, and that was after the U.S. left, more than a year after the President Trump pulled his country out of this deal and reimposed sanctions on Iran. So how can Iran make sure this time around that the U.S. won't renege on its commitments under a new administration and won't scrap the deal again?
Well, as long as the State Department remains in its current form and our Defense Department remains in its current form, you cannot trust the USA at all. Our country is run by gangsters, and it has been for some time. Any promises, any treaties that the U.S. Gives aren't worth the paper they're written on. And we as American people have seen the betrayal of our own government against us and the social contract we have with them via our Constitution. They're running roughshod over us right now. And so our government is not to be trusted. It is run by gangsters. And it's time for regime change within the U.S. and to restore ourselves to a more constitutional republic that respects the will of the people. As it is now, there's more foreign influence, has greater influence over U.S. foreign policy than the American people do. We have lost our voice, and we're being taken for granted, and our form of government, the constitutional republic, is a joke among us American people. We don't believe in the process anymore. And so the primary reason to have nuclear weapons, as Brian, the previous guest, said, is to deter any sort of warfare. And it's such dangerous thinking for the U.S. to think they can win a nuclear war, which is an unwinnable proposition. It is just insanity to do that. We had the MAD doctrine for a number of years with the Soviet Union, where both parties were afraid to engage in a nuclear war, fearing the devastation. Well, bad thinking within the Defense Department, the State Department, has gotten people thinking that they can possibly win this. They're going to end humanity on this planet, and that's not what we're here for. We're here to let's redeploy the war machine, and let's turn it into a war machine into a space exploration and development machine. There's far more profit out there than there's blowing up all life on this planet, and. It's time that I don't care if Iran has a nuclear weapon. The only reason to have one is to keep other people from invading you. And the U.S., through its behavior since 9/11, has proven to the world that they're not afraid to go in and just wreak havoc. They don't win wars. They go in and destroy countries. There's a big mm-hmm. difference between that. And the U.S. is completely unjustified as foreign policy, and shame on our government and the gangsters that run it.
Now, Brian, when it comes to matters of trust and Iran asking for a guarantee, it's, you know, because of things like U.S. Senator Ted Cruz threatening that any future Republican president would tear a deal with Iran. And also we had President Biden just recently telling world countries not to buy Iranian oil, to just keep, sanctioning the country. Are these signs of good faith or bad faith in negotiations? And then they're pushing Iran to go to the negotiating table.
No, it's totally in bad faith, and it's what Ted Cruz is saying, and others would agree with him, I'm afraid, is the United States, is as Mike said, is not the treaties we sign are not worth the paper they're printed on, and it makes it entirely incoherent if the next administration can deny these things. In the United States Constitution, there's the Supremacy Clause, the sixth article of the Constitution, not that that's worth all that much anymore, says that any treaty that the United States enters into and is ratified is the supreme law of the land. So when the United States is violating these treaties, it's violating international law, and it's violating U.S. law, too, and it's undermining as the other guest said, the confidence that anyone can have in the United States government, both foreign and domestic.
Right. Now, Mike, let's talk about Europe, the European side of the Iran nuclear deal. They failed to make good on their promises, of course, under pressure from the U.S., and they didn't keep their own commitments. Later on, they came with their own proposal, a 12-point thing. They didn't live up to that either. So any sign they will this time around?
Well, they're waiting for the U.S. to make a move. The U.S. has really got Europe under its thumb to a great degree, and Europe needs to act independently with or without the U.S., but the pressure doesn't come only from the U.S., but from the global banking cartel, if you will. Mm-hmm. And any country that doesn't play ball and follow this line of hostility against Iran and against Russia and against any other country that is not part of the global banking system, integrated to it and subservient to it, doesn't get treated very well and is portrayed in our media as a pariah state. And so until these things can be addressed and until parity can be brought back and the voice of the people can be heard over the financial interest of the banks and big business, the war machine, et cetera, we're not going to get very far. And it's time, as I said before, it's time for regime change in the U.S., and it's time for us to restructure our global economy in a manner that is more egalitarian and is more beneficial to the people rather than the few oligarchs who end up running these countries and end up setting foreign policy for the entire planet.
Brian, there are some hawks in Washington. They've been speaking of entering negotiations on Iran's missile program. Tehran, of course, has stated this missile program is a deterrent, it's non-negotiable. I mean, how can they ask for, talking about something else and, discussing another deal, whereas they have torpedoed the other one, JCPA that we're talking about. That's one thing. And also, basically, why should Iran negotiate its deterrence? No country would do that.
Yeah, I deplore how much money and resources of the countries of the world are spending on weapons, and I hate to see another weapon system, but I think we have to trace where is this coming from? Why? It's coming from the provocations of the United States, and you can't expect another country to disarm. Now, back on the 29th of last month, Antony Blinken, U.S. Secretary of State, announced more sanctions against Iran over its drone program. And saying that the Iranian-made drones in the region are destabilizing the area, which that was only 2 months after the United States in the city of Kabul killed the Ahmadi family, a family of seven children, using a drone, and thousands of people being killed. How the U.S. drones have been destabilizing Pakistan, Yemen, Afghanistan, and then to have the nerve, the absolute nerve, to say that these Iranian drones, much smaller program, are destabilizing. Perhaps that's true, but that's not for the United States to put sanctions on Iran over their drone program.
Yeah, exactly. And it was the U.S. drone that entered Iranian territorial waters, and Iran brought it down. Iran never did anything like that. Okay, on that note, we come to the end of this edition of The Spotlight. Let me thank our guests. We had editor of The Veterans Today, Mike Harris, joining us from Phoenix, and political commentator and peace activist Brian Terror from Malloy. I've been your host, Behrouz Najafi, and I'll see you next time.
In the limelight.
As Arabs and Muslim communities in the United States were subjected to institutionalized racial profiling, this too frequently encouraged individual anti-Arab and Islamophobic actors who further intimidated and committed acts of violence against Arab and Muslim individuals in everyday life. We now present you an article written by Nadine Naber. The piece is titled, 20 Years After Patriot Act, Surveillance of Arabs and Muslims is Relentless. The United States is now more than 20 years beyond the Patriot Act of October 2001. The immediate aftermath of 9/11 brought a heavy U.S. state focus on Arabs and Muslims in the United States, rationalizing an expansion of policing and surveillance activities against them. It also inspired the convergence of shared struggles for liberation out of a growing consensus that we cannot abolish policing without abolishing U.S. militarism and empire building. The anything-goes context of 9/11 opened up possibilities for expanded forms of policing and surveillance that are unconstitutional. The National Security Entry-Exit Registration System, or NSEERS, also known as Special Registration, put in place by the Department of Justice in 2002, targeted Arabs and Muslims as well as those from West Asia and South Asia. Overly broad interpretations of material support laws denied people, generally Arabs and Muslims, their freedom and even threatened some forms of humanitarian aid. But none of this was entirely new. All this was preceded by President Richard Nixon's Operation Boulder, which law professor Susan Akram has described as perhaps the first concerted U.S. government effort to target Arabs in the United States for special investigation with the specific purpose of intimidation, harassment, and to discourage their activism on issues relating to West Asia. Ironically, Timothy McVeigh's 1995 Oklahoma City attack opened the door to the Clinton administration pushing forward a legislative effort allowing the government to use evidence from secret sources in deportation proceedings for aliens suspected of terrorist involvement. The New York Times reported under the measure, the government would not have to disclose the source of the damaging information to the person whom it is seeking to deport. A white extremist then had carried out a deadly bombing, but it was Arabs and Muslims, including black Arabs and black Muslims, who faced the prospect of deportation without ever being able to confront their accuser, or even know the identity of those accusing them. According to the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU, the 1996 Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act established a new court charged only with hearing cases in which the government seeks to deport aliens accused of engaging in terrorist activities based on secret evidence submitted in the form of classified information. The 1996 Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigration Responsibility Act expanded the secret evidence court so that secret evidence could be more easily used to deport even lawful permanent residents as terrorists. As Arab and Muslim communities were subjected to institutionalized racial profiling, this too frequently encouraged individual anti-Arab and Islamophobic actors who further intimidated and committed acts of violence against Arab and Muslim individuals in everyday life. Between 2000 and 2009, these violent incidents increased by over 500%. Since 2016, 484 incidents of hate-motivated violence have been reported, and many continue to remain unreported. In West Asian, North African, and South Asian regions, of course, the U.S. military killed people en masse while engaging in torture. The U.S. government also supported authoritarian dictators like Egypt's Hosni Mubarak, who would further the U.S. imperialist agenda and simultaneously collaborate in the ongoing colonization of Palestine and the siege of the Gaza Strip. According to the Project on Government Oversight's Jake LaPerouque, the U.S., in its rush to crack down on these domestic communities, swept up international communications on an enormous and unprecedented scale. LaPerouque also notes that internal U.S. communications were surveyed, and as were internet metadata. When eventually disclosed, this surveillance troubled and infuriated people across the political spectrum, some who cared about ending racial profiling of Arabs and Muslims, and some who generally had spent years inflaming such hatred. Many strands of society were incensed that their communications were being monitored by the government, yet those with history in U.S.-based Global South liberation movements, who were targeted by programs like Nixon's counterintelligence program, COINTELPRO, or those whose ancestors were killed via collaborations between the Ku Klux Klan, KKK, and the FBI, knew all too well that the Constitution was meant to protect white supremacy rather than protecting all Americans. The George W. Bush administration had effectively circumvented the Fourth Amendment with its protections against unreasonable searches and seizures. Attempts to override the entirely bankrupt legislative action of the USA Freedom Act of 2015 was a consequence less out of concern over targeting Muslims and Arabs than anger over the widespread sweeping up of so much information about U.S. citizens. Read, white people. I lived through these past 20 years between communities in California, Illinois, and Michigan. The fear was very real. While working-class Arab Muslim immigrant men over the age of 16 were forced to register at their local Immigration and Naturalization Service office as part of the NSEERS program, their loved ones stood outside wondering if they would ever see them again. The reports of violence against Arabs and Muslims and those perceived to belong to those categories were terrifyingly routine. Some stories reached the mainstream media, most circulated simply through word of mouth. Now, in 2021, following the defeat of former President Donald Trump and his open promotion of anti-Muslim policies, we are witnessing the culmination of efforts led by Muslims and Arabs in the United States to build community-based power beyond the psychological and emotional incarceration endured between the Bush and Trump years. The Arab Resource and Organizing Center in California's Bay Area, along with the Arab American Action Network in Chicago, Illinois, have for years fought back in coalition to support anti-imperialist and abolitionist principles. Arabs and Muslim movements are affirming that just because Donald Trump is out doesn't mean these efforts will relent under President Joe Biden, especially not with his interventionist history and long years of support for Israelis' colonial policies that have been killing, containing, and displacing Palestinians with American weaponry. These organizations recognize that U.S. empire building connects movements fighting anti-black police violence, those pressing back against anti-Arab U.S. militarism and the war on terror, as well as groups resisting the militarization of the border and the ongoing colonization of native lands. Shortly after 9/11, I remember the national coalitions like Racial Justice 9/11 that grew overnight when tens of social movements affirmed their unity in the face of the expanding powers of the U.S. nation state. Today, similar coalitions are inspired by the shared concern over the ways U.S. counterinsurgency tactics that repress movements have expanded, violently justifying the repression of blacks, indigenous peoples, and the people of color, and groups like the Movement for Black Lives. When the Bush administration consolidated its internal war on Arabs and Muslims with the Patriot Act, it helped show Donald Trump the power to move a portion of the U.S. public towards increasingly outward-facing white supremacy. Yet, it also set in motion new coalitions. These coalitions have urgently grown out of the imperialist and racist policies implemented first by President George W. Bush, and then even more by Donald J. Trump.